TFM.
This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, your source for the best audiobooks, including unabridged readings of the latest novels from the incredible family of Star Trek authors. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help this show and the network at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 230, Nacelles Sold Separately. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. In this episode, we sit back in our 32nd century programmable matter lounge chairs and reflect on Star Trek Discovery Season 3, discussing how the story played out compared with what we expected, how we feel about key plot points, and how it all fits into the overall Star Trek picture. We also look ahead to Season 4 and speculate on what the writers might have in store for us. The far future awaits, so let's step into the Ready Room. Well, hello, Larry. I thought you would be here in the Ready Room waiting around. What do you think about the place? You know, I've spruced it up again. I went over to Space IKEA. I went down the programmable matter aisle they have there. I got us a couple of programmable matter Barca loungers here so we can, you know, sit back and talk about Star Trek Discovery Season 3 today.
Wait, I'm sorry. Wait, one of your programmable matter Barca loungers is 5 feet off the floor and at a 42-degree angle. And the other one is out the window. So I don't know. Oh, wait, programmable matter. It doesn't have to make sense. It's just cool. Okay,
that's right. Well, see, Larry, it knows that you prefer to sit at a 42-degree angle. You know, it kind of adapts your leisure time to your own personal way of relaxing.
Oh, okay, I see. And, you know, it's just a wannabe programmable matter Barca lounger. Someday it will grow up and tilt at a 47-degree angle. So,
also, okay. Larry, remember, I told you I went to Space IKEA, not Space Herman Miller. So these aren't like the best quality programmable matter Barca loungers we could buy. So we're just working with what we can here. I had a few extra screws left over also after I put them together. So
excuse me, Herman Miller. Well, okay. I love their macaroni and cheese.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, that's something else. Okay.
All right. Well, it's been a while since we were together here in the Ready Room. And last time we actually were getting ready for Season 3 Discovery to premiere. We talked about our expectations for the season, what the story might be. I think we talked about the episode titles, a few of which actually changed, and what that might mean for the story. And now we've seen the whole season, so it's time for us to talk about how it played out.
Yeah, and one title that did not change, which was very cool, and was exactly what we predicted. That's what the whole world predicted. Unification 3, but we can get to that.
Oh, I thought for sure you were talking about People of Earth, but People of Titan.
People of Titan, whatever.
Which actually, that episode turned out to be one of my favorites of the season.
Mm-hmm. It did, although I kept thinking, you know, we got the poor Romulans and Vulcans who are spanning, you know, a couple of sectors at least and lots of light years. And it's a big thing when they finally get together. And they knew each other back in the day. They knew to stay away, but they wanted to get together. And here the big reveal of People of Earth is that these guys that live out around, oh, you know, I could make the joke about Uranus, but these guys that live in the outer edge of the solar system have somehow just in 100 years gotten isolated, cut off from the folks on Earth. But anyway, I realize as the season went along that some of the dots that are sprinkled through this season are really interesting. Like when you have enough time to stand back and put things together, such as for all the talk about Earth having withdrawn from the Federation with a little brass plaque under it. This is withdrawn from the Federation, you know, and they've lost track of their outer. I guess they're trying to do their own spinoff of the Expanse. They've lost track of their outer colonists, you know, and the freighters from humans from the outer system. There's lots, unless there's some kind of sneaky original series style. Oh, we look just like humans, but we're really aliens, you know, like Admiral Vance. Unless they're that kind of alien, you know, low makeup budget. We don't even have enough money for bumpy foreheads. There's a lot of humans still running around in Starfleet, in case you hadn't noticed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, 90% of the background and front ground people appear to be humans. So this whole thing about Earth being withdrawn from future Federation, I mean, it's an interesting topic. It's like, was it really more of a split on Earth? We're jumping it ahead here. But anyway, that's one of the things that with a little bit of distance and the dust settling, you kind of go, hey, wait a minute. Even as things are starting to shift once again by the end of the season. But we should start at square one.
Yeah.
Go back to the red suit and
because
all that.
Yeah. This is a very interesting topic. And it's one of those elements that I would have liked to have known more about as the season went on, but sort of got pushed to the side.
Make a list.
Start a list, right.
Yeah.
There are a lot of them. Well, I think as a good starting point, as I mentioned last time when we talked, we were getting ready for the season. It was just days before the premiere. And we had some expectations on what the story might be. We knew that the Federation had shrunk down to a handful of worlds. We didn't know how many.
Or at least their flag had.
The flag had. Well, the flag had. But we had that idea that, yeah, something like the Federation has fallen. And if I recall, we certainly knew from the creators that the cause of the Federation's collapse or decline was due to some events that were maybe beyond their control. It wasn't simply that the society itself had collapsed because of some kind of internal strife or something like that. So we wanted to know, well, what might have caused that? And the one thing I'm trying to remember, did we have the seeds already that something had happened to all the dilithium?
I don't know that it was specifically about dilithium, but what was really striking me when we last talked was how people who were debating this whole idea of, oh, future Federation, it's fallen, and how illogical is that? And I said, I'm sorry, but for the 12 years of the fallow years and then still more, every pitch that every professional and every wannabe professional put out there for their idea of a future Star Trek show was all about, I'll see your post 9/11 mood and raise you 10. I mean, it was, everything was going to be, you know, we're going to have the pendulum swing of the Federation hitting a peak. And for some reason, not being the Federation we know today, because we want a dramatic contrast the way we always have. And so it's everything from, you know, Dave Rossi and that animated series, Final Frontier.
Yeah.
Right. Final Frontier, to even the things that you heard Brian Singer and Brian Fuller putting out there, but that somehow we weren't, you know, it was not a happy dappy bridge and crew and all of that. But the meta reason for that is because it's not just their little personal lives. It was the whole background of the known galaxy, the known space of the galaxy that we know from past. Something had really disrupted. There was some huge disruptive force, which 15 years ago, that felt like it was a thing to use as a dramatic metaphor for the times, because we were in the whole, war on terror and all that. Well, after a couple of depressions and the disruptive influences of social media and the cultural aspects that have shifted rightward around the world climate change, everything.
Yeah.
Disruption seems to be our middle name just up and down the board. So all these themes made total sense. And the fact that that's where Discovery went, aside from being in the water for the last 15 years from everybody putting any thought into it, made total sense to me. But that's exactly what we got. But we got it with an arc. It's not static. It's starting at a place and going somewhere. And of course, our heroes are having something to do with making change there.
I think climate change is a big part of it as well. Especially, that was my thought going in terms of if something happened that made travel difficult, something happened to the dilithium, something disrupted communications, something beyond the control of the society. Well, it's not really. I mean, we have some control, right? We could make efforts to reverse climate change and mitigate the damage that's coming our way. I don't think we're going to, but we could. Mm-hmm. We could make more of an effort. So in that sense, it's sort of within our control, but at the same time, it's nature. And so a lot of elements are not under our control.
Right. But then even more immediate was the fact of the pandemic began. And right, everyone right. felt those effects, and everybody immediately kind of felt an affinity there as a metaphor with the season beyond our control,
except,
even though the whole thing was written, you know, they were finishing right. up post when the pandemic
broke. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So you definitely feel that parallel, mm-hmm. and it's easy to feel like it's a ripped from the headlines kind of story in places here and there, but yet it's not because it was written. It just shows how these threats are, they're like bigger picture themes of things that we must contend with as a civilization if we're going to mm-hmm. not only build a certain quality of life, but also maintain that for 1,000 years. There will be many, many challenges down the road.
Well, right. Well, the thing I keep trying to go back to is something I've always done in Star Trek. Whenever we talk about, you know, just simply think of projected technology, like go back to square one with transporters and warp drive and all that, is, okay, look how far we've come. Look at some of the fringes, like miniaturization. Flip-top communicators were huge in the 60s. They were so futuristic. And then within 40 years, that was a norm, right? iPads were the pads of next generation. So some of these aspects, you know, universal translators, you know, in your ear, I mean, so many aspects of wacky doodle future Star Trek technology from day one, pieces are coming true. We still got a ways to work on transporters, damn it. But you know, it's projected science. And if people still have a problem with different degrees of that, I still go back to it. Well, look at life 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Look how much would have been disguised or seen to be magic. Or some charlatan's going to run out and, you know, a snake oil salesman would be able to, you'd have an Ardra situation, right?
Right.
From Devil's Due. I mean, how much of that?
I just watched that last night.
Yeah. So, oh, come on, wake up. Yes. But I mean, you'd have that kind of a situation where the possessor of higher technology can go play magician or wizard or god, you know, with the lesser developed people. We've had a huge amount of that just in the last 100 years, 150 years. We've only had flight for barely 120 years now. So much less space flight. Yeah. So when we go the other direction and go forward, that's why I don't want to jump the gun here too much, but the programmable matter throws me because I'm used to thinking Star Trek just a little ahead, but now Star Trek is ahead of itself. So it's like, okay, I get. 10 years before Kirk and Spock, I had a problem with smart holograms that you knew where your projected recipient's furniture was laid out. So you could walk around and sit in it. That didn't make a lot of sense. But if you want to come up and say, okay, programmable matter, here's the thing. And, you know, they do have science consultants. And, shout out to Dr. Aaron McDonald and Dr. Mohammed Noor, who are working on different aspects of science. There is a consistency. They do have consultants. I think that's a big improvement this year. And it's like they even got to brag a little with some of, like, the seed colony, you know, the seed repository. Mm-hmm. There were times when that kind of popped up, but I'm more comfortable with that end, with the crazy future science and being able to say, oh, it's 800, 900, 1,000 years in the future than some of the things we've had to kind of wince about just the last year or two. But I thought that was another positive of the year.
Okay, well, let's stick with programmable matter for a moment. It's interesting because when we first see it, we see it being used for furniture, like a bed or a desk, mm-hmm. and it moves around the room. And that makes a lot of sense. Like that, I could easily wrap my mind around the idea that you've got this bulk amount of programmable matter that can take any form that you need it to. And you could probably even, like today with HomeKit, with smart speakers and smart lights and all, you can set scenes where, you know, it's 5 p.m. and it triggers something and it lowers the blinds and it changes the color of the lights and it turns on the, you know, it does all this stuff. You could program it so that it just knows that in the morning when you get out of bed, it's going to turn itself into your desk while you're brushing your teeth or whatever. That makes perfect sense. And also, when we see them create equipment for them to repair Discovery using mm-hmm. programmable matter, that also makes sense because there's some sort of matrix to it where you're telling it, take this form and create this object, and it could come out of a database or a library. And that makes perfect sense. The area where it didn't make sense to me, and it feels like they're just going, hey, it's the future, is using it as controls for flight mm-hmm. or managing the control panels, because we don't see any indication of how would you know what to touch? You just put your hands on it and it somehow it connects with your mind and it just knows what you want to do, which is that's how it seems to be working. But that's a bit more of a stretch for me. And then we do have that explanation about how, well, you know, we've retrofitted the control panels and it works differently for different people because it knows like how you like to work. And I thought, okay, well, that's also a very interesting idea. But it's one of those things where over time, and maybe we'll see it in season 4, over time, we might learn more about how it works because we would have scenes where we just see someone working with the control panel, like Data working with the LCARS mm-hmm. on the Enterprise D or something like that. And we kind of learn it so it makes sense to us. So far, we haven't gotten that. So in that respect, programmable matter feels like, hey, it's the future. We're just going to throw this in here and please do not ask us how it works. Except for every other aspect of programmable matter, it's fine. And you can easily see it as being like the evolution of 3D printing or something like that.
Well, part of what also eased my way into that. Now, the nature of it, I think is what you're getting at here, is the nature is okay. It's like, what are the specific uses we've seen with it? And the control interface kind of threw me. It's almost one of those things where, oh, cool, this is so unexplained that we can, I mean, I could be mean here and talk about the Kelvin universe, but it was really original series. I've chalked it up for years to we're so busy not getting any sleep trying to get this crazy new paradigm of a show done. Please mm-hmm. ask us later exactly what dilithium does. And please ask us later how the warp right. drive works and the transporter work, you know. How, you know, we'll work these things out on the run, and then maybe in that 20-year mm-hmm. gap in between series, we'll sit down and retcon everything to make it all work, make sense now. So I can kind of forgive a little bit of that, but I guess also what helps me out a little bit is knowing that now with Picard, we saw 3D holographic controls, like ship interface right. controls, and that seemed right. like a huge leap. Like, what do you do when that goes out? Do you have manual overrides and the whole list?
That's a good question.
Yeah, the fact that they it's such a trusted technology only 25 years after we saw the run of Next Generation and even into Nemesis. And it was a big thing to have a joystick pop up. That was amazing. On a bridge.
Well, I was going to say, if you're wondering what happens when the holographic control panels in front of you go out, on Riker's ship, a joystick pops up right in the middle and you can control the ship that way. I don't know what happens on other ships, but on Riker's ship, there's a joystick. He always has all of his ships retrofitted with a joystick.
All right, Will, put your joystick away. I know. I don't want to go there. Thinking that if you're going to take the supposition within 20 and 30 years, this kind of technology has not only been, you know, invented, it's probably in testing phase and R&D phase as we left the filmed universe the last time we saw it before Picard, like Nemesis era. Mm-hmm. But here it's been deployed. At least it's been deployed. Look, it's not even in the, I don't know, do we ever see it in a major ship? We only see Riker's Bridge, which is really Discovery's Bridge. Don't say anything. Or the Enterprise Bridge, I think it actually was. Yeah, it was the Enterprise Bridge for Riker's backdrop. But yeah, it's not only been deployed, it's trusted. And either that's early cutting edge that only the independent guys like Rios have installed in his little Millennium Falcon. I mean, I'm sorry, in the La Serena. It's either the ragtags that are zooming out and trusting it, and it hasn't migrated to the mainstream fleet yet, or it has been in the mainstream fleet, and it's trickled down to the one-off, you know, independently owned ships. So either way, I mean, it seems like it might be a little dicier with the former, with the fact that it's coming to the independent ships first, and it's not Starfleet standard yet. But clearly the technology is mm-hmm. out there. And when we see them go to Free Cloud, I know I've zoomed over to Picard, but I mean, the level of technology there such that if we're talking, again, 800, 900 years in the future, and we had holographic tactile controls in 2399. That's why I was a little, I was like, okay, fine. They'll explain it later. It's fine. You know, and the show people are all going, oh, look at this cool new production CGI technology. Look, it's dribbling oozy matter that follows. It's like magnetized to your finger. Ooh.
Right.
You know, it's like the little wacky iron pellets drawing things with the magnet. You know,
yeah,
you
that's
like
what
drag
I was thinking
it,
of.
Put
yeah.
the mustache on yeah, the exactly. guy's face. Yeah,
right.
How old are we, Chris?
Well, that's okay. what they're doing when they're not in a battle. They're just sitting up there. You know, they're flying mm-hmm. somewhere, and it takes like 4 days to get there. They're just drawing mustache. They've got like Saru's face on the panel.
Yeah,
and Detmer's just drawing mustaches on Saru's face. Yeah,
this is why we don't keep the camera on Alusican and Detmer so often. They're just up there putting glasses on Saru's face. Yeah,
exactly.
What would mirror putting a goatees on mirror Saru's face? Just wondering what that would.
So it'll be interesting to see what they do with the programmable matter. Like, I don't have a problem with it in principle, but I just was kind of having a hard time figuring out how do you control the ship this way. And you, it's one of those things that as you watch the story, you just take it, okay, that's how they fly the ship. Don't worry about it.
Well,
but within Star Trek, you kind of want to know how the engineering works.
Really?
Because that throughout the show, you know, people didn't watch Star Trek and decide they want to become engineers just because they said, I'm sure that panel works somehow. I'm not worried about it. They're like paying attention. This is how everything works on a starship. I want to build this for real.
What was the very second professionally printed book on Star Trek I ever bought? What was the first available large format Star Trek book that was even available out there? But the original series tech manual. So yeah, I think there might be one or two people interested in this. Well, before we leave this topic though, your whole realm of concern was about the interface, the control interfaces.
It's not a concern. It's just an observation.
Right. But the thing that I observed to me, the one that was, and here I am falling back into a logic issue. I mean, fine, explain it to me, but also explain to me what the point is. Besides, it's just cool. We'll figure out a reason later. It's just cool. The whole detached nacelle.
Yeah, that
I saw people just trying to figure, you know, people were upset about how people would, do they have to beam if they're out working in the nacelle tubes and they have to like beam over to the bathroom or to get back to their quarters or something?
Right.
But I'm thinking like in battle, and now I do see that they like draw up. It's so funny. It's like they draw back together when they go to warp.
Yeah.
So I guess warp fields and subspace bubbles are, it's harder to create them around three pieces than one, which makes sense. But otherwise,
maybe.
when you're just out flying an impulse, you know, in real space time, is there an advantage to having flying around your nacelles detached? I don't know.
The one advantage that they do mention in dialogue is that it improves maneuverability.
Okay,
although
so,
I don't
know
how. It seems like it would be harder to maneuver if you've got things floating along the sides, but I guess they've got it all worked out.
It's like you're driving along and you decide to make your one axle 4 feet wider on each end than your car body, but keep the other axle at the same width because it looks cool or something. No, it's easier to maneuver.
Well, you know,
it is.
Just wait for next year on Mario Kart 9. All the carts in Mario Kart are going to have detached wheels. They're just rolling along the side of the carts. Now, I think the real explanation, Larry, is that
cars in the future world, when they're zooming across the desert, they'll be
in the creative department of Discovery. One afternoon, they were thinking about, okay, we need to design some new ships, you know, for this scene when we go to Federation headquarters. And then one person said, did you see the ships that Eagle Moss did from last season? God, they did such a fantastic job of recreating our ships. And then the other person said, oh yeah, hold my beer. Detach nacelles. They're just trying to punk Eagle Moss. They're like,
and of course,
Eagle Moss, everyone's like, okay, we've got to figure out how to do detached parts.
No. I'm sure Ben will have the right take on this. Eagle Moss would just sell the ship bodies and say, nacelle sold separately.
Exactly.
Are you kidding? It was all a big conspiracy, Chris. It was all a big conspiracy.
Exactly. I do think that they have done some of them now, haven't they? I assume they're using like clear plastic to go.
I think, yeah, they've come up with devices to,
But I remember the first time when we go in there and we see the detached nacelles, I think so many of us, our first thought was, how is Eagle Moss going to make those?
Well, see, part of this, though, is, and here again, it's 1,000 years. I'm going to go all tech head here and, you know, and fill in your favorite techie podcast here. I'm totally willing for them to give me a reason. But if you stop and think, the whole reason for nacelles is to contain very dense warp coils and to take the flow of the warp plasma away from, which is still contained in the main body of the ship, you know, your standard engineering hull, secondary hull. But the warp plasma goes out and then penetrates the warp coils, and that helps create the subspace field, the bubble, right? So the fact that you've already got, they suck together, though, for warp drives, which to me means that physically the warp plasma has to go through some kind of an attach point that seals up when they do go to warp. And but otherwise, when they're not at warp and they're at impulse or just hanging there, there's no need for the warp plasma to get out to the nacelles. So, okay, that's good, but still there's got to be some overarching reason for, okay it's going to maneuver at impulse. Is that in battle?
Yeah. Because
we very rarely see battles with, you know, warp drive. That'd be kind of ridiculous. Unless you're just getting the hell out of there. That's your warp drive in battle.
Did we see any situation in one of these ships or the refitted Discovery?
We've gone so tech head here. Yeah.
I know. Where the warp plasma goes to the nacelles, because one thing I'm thinking is maybe it's kind of dangerous to have antimatter and warp plasma and all in the main hull of the ship where you've got all the people. So maybe they've devised a way where all of that is stored in the nacelles themselves.
Well,
and then they're detached from the ship, which would be safer.
If you've totally, well, then you would have a completely contained warp core mixing the matter and antimatter together there through the dilithium matrix, going out to the nacelle, and each nacelle has its own power plant. Now, if that's what's happening, and yes, you get away from the old bugaboo of, you know, warp core breach, we've got a warp core breach, and then there's no safety doors for any heroic engineers to roll under and show off.
or to get trapped inside and have to sacrifice themselves because someone forgot to put a open door switch on the inside of the room. It's only on the outside.
or the 24th or 32nd century O-rings are leaking warp plasma. Yeah. We're breathing warp plasma. And heaven forbid the trilithium. See, it's like, I mean, on one hand, it's kind of cool. It's like, is there still trilithium around for terrorists to suck up? And, you know, is, I don't know. I mean, if dilithium itself is treated like jewelry in a store and locked up under, you know, lock and key and force field, you know, like the way they see in the opening episode there, where it's in that training post. Anyway, it's all cool stuff, and maybe it's been thought out. And as people are allowed to open their mouths and tell us, or sell the book that has this in, or whatever, according to the 2022 world, I can see.
I'm sure someone will sell a book, Larry, that explains all this.
Because I hope
it's all about merchandising these days.
It's sitting there, and I say that there's a lot of good. I finally gotten to start meeting some of the creatives, and some of them just as clueless as we are. But anyway, know that not. it's a lot of good people working on things, and people still trying to do their best. So I'm not trying to cast any aspersions on anyone here.
Okay, but it is a good point that, you know, it's easy for us with 55 years of Star Trek technology under our belt, so look at the stuff and say, like, it should all make perfect sense. That's right out belt. Of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a huge.
Well, no, I mean, yes, you know, but I was saying.
We're getting older, Larry, so that belt is expanding.
You had people, 55 years, it can't help it. But, there's a lot of Trek under that belt or something. But even in the 70s, people were already madly trying to retcon and make sense of the poor 60s level of knowing anybody would care about this past a first run and a rerun. Is somebody even going to see this? Oh, they did. Oh, they're collecting film clips to compare what we did from season one to season two. Oops. And we did. And then the next series starts off with people sitting down and trying to, you know, thank you, Rick and Mike, for trying to preemptively keep things on track. And then within a few years, they're deriding that as technobabble. But hey, it was better than having it, you know, be all over the place.
Yeah.
Oh, we're talking about Discovery season 3. We should talk.
Yeah, let's get back to that. So my final point on this would be that even though some of the stuff doesn't really make sense, we've often had things in Star Trek technology mm-hmm. that doesn't make sense out of the gate, and it evolves over time. And maybe that will be the same here, and we'll find out a little bit more. We'll have that one episode right. in season 4 where it's just like a masterclass in programmable matter. You know, like somehow Geordi LaForge and Data will both end up in the future. I know it's complicated for that to happen, and Data's gone, and Geordi would also be gone at this point, but it is Star Trek. And we did meet the Guardian of Forever this season again, so who knows? And they will do a PowerPoint presentation, just like on The Next Generation. They'll get everybody in a room lined up at a table, and they will explain for 4 hours how this all works, and then right. we'll all know.
We'll have some 47Z pink ray holograms or something, of programmable hollow matter or something, proto matter. That's what it'll be. Yeah. It'll be safe proto matter, and they'll need the
safe
lesson.
Proto matter. Yes.
Yeah.
Ooh,
the biggest yeah. the biggest revolution in 32nd century technology. I'll just say that I'm much more comfortable having question marks like this and blank checks, and we'll wait to have it explained now. I mean, because my overall guiding principle here is I said and predicted, and it's happened, like this was a no-brainer, that Discovery feels more like it's at home and in its own skin now, to me, yeah. than it ever did in the first 2 seasons. So,
well, yeah, because they've jumped to a place where they can establish everything for themselves instead of trying to wedge mm-hmm. themselves into everything that we already know. So that makes a really big difference. So, okay, let's get back into the story a little bit. We already talked a bit about
story,
the Fractured
Shmari.
Federation at the beginning and how that fits in mm-hmm. to the overall Star Trek franchise. We see the foundation being laid for the Federation and Enterprise. And then between Enterprise and Discovery, along that timeline, the Federation actually is formed. And then now we're in the far future and it started to collapse. Where do you think it goes from here? Can they rebuild the Federation as it was before? Would that be the appropriate storyline?
No, Chris, they just give up. They just give up and sit at home.
But remember how big it was and what it is mm-hmm. now. So they can bring it back together in a sense. But maybe not actually take us back to those days of having however many planets. Well, I forget what Admiral Vance says in here.
Look how much of the globe the Roman Empire occupied compared to today. Mm-hmm. Look how much of the globe Genghis Khan's Mongol Empire occupied compared to today. So things, you know, there's entropy. Entropy. All of a sudden they had Kirk in immunity syndrome there. Entropy.
That's also one of the titles of a season 4 episode, I believe.
Oh, okay. Yay. Yes.
Entropy. Yeah. Yeah. Breaking news. Exclusive, as everyone likes to say on Twitter these days.
Oh, okay. I think it's fine. Again, this was a theme that everybody trying to come up with, you know, pitch new ideas for a modern sensibility that contrasted with the happiness of right. the 90s Trek. That's kind of where people were going anyway. What I thought was interesting was, and I think when you have these broad strokes, I think they carried them off pretty well. I think in the day-to-day humble jumble of trying to write on deadline and film in Canada and write in LA and all of that, I think they've got the act of writing and structuring episodes. I think they're really getting more at home with serialized storytelling in a Star Trek lens. I think that's come a long way since the first year. And I think that's, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, that's crossing over all the series. They're getting better at it and it's feeling better. And I've said many times, as this season unwound, this was the first time that I felt like I could learn, like I watched an episode, not only did it have its own sense of identity, even though, yes, there mm-hmm. are arcs, right, going by, but it's not like it was just one chapter of 5 layers of arcs right. that were just a definitely. Blur, right? You yeah, each one had definitely. A personality and a story. And even though there's it's 2020, we're not allowed to have titles on screen anymore. But I actually feel like I can actually learn a title, or a title makes sense, or even if it's Latin or something that it actually retains. I can actually feel like I can talk about individual episodes.
About.
Yeah. You remember exactly. the title, the episode, and the main thing, rather than it just being, you remember the opening, you remember the season opener and the season finale, and then one really standout oddball show in the middle of the year, you know?
Yeah. Right.
This season felt like I knew the titles. I was that way with Picard too, but for Discovery, this is the first time, which to me just is a symbol, is a barometer that the storytelling and the structuring is getting there. And I thought it was very brave to do the first one totally just with Michael, totally apart from the ship. I mean, the actors were all going to get paid, but it was the regulars anyway. But it was great. I thought it was a very daring move to do just story-wise.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it was interesting too. And it showed that time itself is not concrete, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they came through together, but they landed a year apart, right? And it shows how the effects of time can differ. And that plays into the whole temporal accords thing, which I thought was interesting that they went back to Enterprise and they pulled this whole temporal Cold War thing into the storyline, mm-hmm. even though they didn't make a big deal about it. But they talked about it enough that it actually connected all of that stuff from Enterprise with Daniels and Archer and the temporal Cold War. It pulled it more into the timeline and it connected, sort of like bookends.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a thread running through. It's no longer like that weird B story on Enterprise anymore. It's now part of like the whole history of the Federation, right?
And it's so reeks of something that Discovery can take and like run with, especially since they've got another 1,000 mm-hmm. years to add to. Now, the whole Short Trek's Calypso saga has been bedeviling people all year. Well, even before the season debuted, people were, how does that work? Mm-hmm. And we still don't know the connection, although you've got Zora, the computer, we've got that connection coming out of the sphere of last season. That seems to be lingering. You had the actual terms, Zadresh used here.
Yeah.
Which was used by the computer, which was a corrupted version of Federation. So you've had some crumbs laid in here, but no one's in a rush to get, you know, all the way through it.
So it'll be interesting to see where they go with the Federation. And actually, we'll talk about that towards the end when we talk about season 4. So another thing I wanted to talk about was the very interesting episode written by our friend Kirsten Beyer, Unification 3, which mm-hmm. we assumed would be a continuation in some way of Unification 1 and 2.
We saw that coming a mile away, right? If you're paying attention.
You know, I love that they actually changed the name of the planet to Navarre, which mm-hmm. does come from the books. There is a whole backstory to that, which most people probably don't know unless you're into the Trek lit.
It was way, way back. Yes, it was back almost zine days and fan fiction days. Yeah.
Now, there's one meme that was going around online that I love. It was the crazy guy from Ancient Aliens, the TV show, mm-hmm. that had a still of him and his crazy hair. And at the bottom, it says Navarre. And at the bottom, it says, now it's Vulcans and Romulans. N-I-V-A-R. But the other thing I thought was really interesting and clever about this is how it starts to pull together the events of the Prime timeline and the Kelvin timeline. Mm-hmm. Because with Discovery, if you go back to season 1, fans love to have this debate about whether the show itself is in the Prime timeline or in the Kelvin timeline. Even though the writers said clearly it's Prime, people didn't want to believe them. But anyway, here you're taking the cataclysmic events that set off the Kelvin timeline, the branching, and you've brought the Romulans and the Vulcans together, and you've tied it into Spock's mission and the Next Generation. But the other interesting thing is that you can feel that even though you're 1,000 years down the road, and it took a few hundred years, I think they said on the show, after the Next Generation events for the unification to occur, mm-hmm. you still get the feeling that on Navarre, the Vulcans and the Romulans and then the hybrid now, the people who are half Vulcan, half Romulan, because now there are many, many of those people, and we see each group represented, they're still kind of learning how to live together, even at this point.
Yeah, well, yeah, nothing is, it's they've almost got three factions even, which was really fascinating to watch. Yeah. It's nice drama to have three. That's much more interesting than having a triangle is much more interesting than a just black and white, you know, conflict line. And just the fact that Nevar goes back to T negative. I mean, like the original Spock and Vulcan fanzines, which were the original Trek fanzines. Mm-hmm. And yes, I know fanzines mm-hmm. was a sci-fi fan thing. I'm talking Trek fanzines, everybody. But that's where modern Trek fandom came from. That was the first passion point, that energy that drove everything else eventually, really. So it was awesome that they went back to that root word and used it. And the promise of, you know, you got a hint of this. The first couple of episodes were, you know, Burnham on her own and reuniting with the ship, and they had to work through all that. And then they're going to start laying out this mystery of the burn and what is this with Book? And it really was like peeling back an onion. It really was just starting with a small scope here and gradually expanding your horizons as you, it's almost like you've woke up in a new place and you have to walk a mile, and then later eventually you walk 5 miles, and then eventually you can walk 10, you know, and just unpeeling that universe. And that's really the point of view here. And they get home, the spore drive is still working. They get home mm-hmm. and learn this wacky situation with Earth, although the big tree at Starfleet Academy is still there, which was an interesting moment. And then as they start to kind of bop around the familiar, you know, here's one thing, Chris. Didn't we all know deep in our hearts at the end of season two that they didn't really just go to Terra Elysium, and that the new season wasn't just going to pick up with them being at Terra Elysium? And we see all the, the 800, 930 years, whatever, of progress at the site of the church, right? New Haven and all of that. But mm-hmm. you knew that they weren't, it wasn't. Maybe, and maybe not the time either. I mean, you've got two fixed dimensions here in space-time, the space and the time. So they wound up
right.
doing the duration of the Red Angel suit, but the location didn't work. And they were both, a year apart in time, even at that, but in the same location and mm-hmm. not there. And they had spore drive. They weren't stuck out in the Beta Quadrant. They very much were bopping around Trill and Nevar and Earth and all of that, you know, old space, and wind up just kind of a little of the left of the old, if you can trust the map, the star map in Vance's office, they're kind of a little left of the old original core of the Federation, but on the west side, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting to see west all these
side
things.
On the west side of the Federation.
Yeah. I'm corrupting my, yeah. If you have a standard two-dimensional, which is, I know, anachronistic, if you have your standard view with the Galactic Center up top, okay, fine.
A little left of the Federation.
Over towards Bajor and Cardassia. Come on. But of the old, you know, over where past Teller a little bit, although I know we've never been there, so how many people know exactly where that is? But my point here is the more they were kind of bopping around the original homeworlds of the Alpha Quadrant and Trill and all that, it was like they were ticking off the boxes and going around. But we all knew they weren't just going to be off at Terra Elysium and coming around. So anyway, Nevar was interesting. And the fact that it's like, okay, we will tell you what happened with the Vulcans, Romulans, and reunification. And I'll raise you the fact that they're settling in and still a little factionalized, and they still get a little rabbly and have to, you know, have, but even by the end of the year here, we've seen that they're looking at coming back to the Federation. I mean, it's good. We're back in Star Trek time where things start happening in the last 5-10 minutes of the episode. So, you know, Trill is talking about coming back. We didn't even talk about the Trill episode, which was amazing to watch. Because, you know, there'd been no Trill development since, like, third season of DS9. Mm-hmm. They were right on the verge of talking about the great Trill scandal.
Well, there's some...
Where most humanoid Trills could host.
Yeah, there's a bit in the seventh season of DS9. We actually go to Trill, so we get a little bit of the social development there. But
I'm talking about, yeah, but it was like, it didn't really get into the culture and this whole thing that had been set up. That's what I kept trying to pitch stories, and I kept wondering why we've not seen, well, I think there is a book maybe about this. But anyway, I just thought the Trill was the great arrested culture for all the attention paid to that. And we'll talk about that with Adira and Gray here. But
But
anyway, looking at some of the civilizations one by one of what their status is, 800 years in the future, much less the last 100 years post-burn, because that's apparently the only thing that matters. Everything was hunky-dory for, you know, the first 800 or so years until the burn happened. And, as long as they're peeling back layers of the onion for the mystery of that, it's all well and good and pretty engrossing. I really liked the way the middle part of the season was unfolding. They were finding clues, but they were also getting around to all the common worlds that we knew and seeing what was going on.
Right, right. And, okay, so that's interesting that the way the middle part of the season was developing, I also really enjoyed because I want to talk about the resolution of the mystery a little bit and what caused the burn. Because
oh, you too, huh?
So for most of the season, I felt like Burnham's pursuit of the cause of the burn was interesting, and she was approaching it the way you would expect her to approach it as someone who grew up on Vulcan and went to the Vulcan Science Academy, and she's looking for a scientific explanation for what happened. And then you find out that the Navarians, I guess we would call them now, the Vulcans and the Romulans on
the Navari,
you know, like they actually think that they caused the burn as part mm-hmm. of their scientific mm-hmm. and engineering research, just as you would expect someone during that time period to kind of think might be the case. And just given that it's Star Trek, you kind of expect the explanation to be more grounded in science. And I feel like the explanation, from a purely storytelling point of view, if you just want to tell a story, okay, it's fine. But for me, it was very unsatisfying. And I did make a comment on Twitter about how I think actually I didn't make mm-hmm. just a blind comment. I was actually having a conversation with Brandon, I think it was. And then someone butted into the conversation and said, hey, but it is all based in science. And here's a link to an article on StarTrek.com where the science advisors break down the science behind the burn. And so I went through and read it, and all it was basically telling you what Culber says in the episode mm. where he talks about how Sukar, because he came to the planet when he was a child, that he's sort of intertwined with the planet. But there's no actual real scientific explanation provided, even in that article that I was sent by someone who wanted to tell me that I was crazy for thinking that it wasn't scientific enough. So maybe, yes, you can like find some phenomenon in nature and try to tie that in and explain how someone would be linked with the environment so that when they get scared and they scream, the vibrations go through subspace and shatters all the dilithium in the entire galaxy within a microsecond of each other. Maybe you can, but I personally wanted to find out that the burn was caused by some sort of natural phenomenon that could be a parallel to climate change mm-hmm. or some mm-hmm. environmental issue, where the explanation is more like a warning to us about how we need to view and approach our own world and our natural environment, because what's happening to the climate could be a threat to the existence of our civilization. To me, that's what I was expecting from Star Trek. And then we got something that was actually an emotional, mm-hmm. more than anything, it was about emotions. It was about this one person feeling emotionally hurt. And to me, that just, it was very unsatisfying as an explanation.
Yeah, you think it missed the boat on what you were hoping or thinking it would be. We overmined Praxis, or warp drive is polluting subspace. That there was something a crisis that we were to blame for, and we had to find a way out of. We had to find a solution.
We killed all the humpback whales, right?
Yeah.
And we have to go, something that we did. It's like a big picture mm-hmm. issue that could be addressed if we warned ourselves about it. We had some sort of warning about it. Not that it's one person who has an emotional outburst and therefore causes hundreds and hundreds of planets to be disconnected from one another.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you got, the big worms that Booker's is looking after.
The transworms, yeah.
The transworms. He's coming in over the transform.
Yeah.
The transform.
But
the transform, yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? So, like, I'm not...
No, I totally understand.
And I'm sure there are people listening and who would say that, oh, you're just hating on Discovery. You just think you think emotions aren't important. That's not what I'm saying at all. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about, is it a satisfying solution for the mystery that was posed at the start and what you're expecting, especially given what happened all through the middle of the season with Burnham's pursuit, because she was on a scientific mission to find mm-hmm. out what the cause was. And even Vance and the other guy with the glasses, because they make him look smart, talked about how there have been many theories about what may have caused the burn. And most of those theories are scientifically based or some sort of attack on us, which would also be using some sort of natural phenomenon.
Yeah. And I had another observation too, because, you know, I don't know if you know this, but people have talked once or twice about this in the past few months. I had an observation too that I think that was obviously designed to be an overarching, cool, season-long arc that could be chipped away at show by show, right? Not dominate mm-hmm. any one episode mm-hmm. until the payoff came mm-hmm. up. So that's all cool. That's fine. But I think that had this been a one-off episode story, or had the mystery of the burn and then the payoff to what it really was, had that been a self-contained episode, I don't mm-hmm. think, I think your reaction, I think the stakes wouldn't have been so high. Not stakes as in personally, but the stakes of the weight of the season-long arc is on this. There are two or three season-long arcs. This was one of them. But this was like the big tangible mystery arc. And, you know, the thing that kept you tuning back every week to see what the latest clues were, how far they've gotten. And I think if that'd just been a one-off episode, if we just come up to a planet that all of a sudden, blam, everything within a so much radius, the dilithium's been knocked mm-hmm. out, and we go to the planet and find out the guy, find the kid that screamed, and that's what caused yeah. it. I think people right. would go, well, that's interesting. And a lot of people might have thought, wow, yeah. how creative to mix something organic exactly. with something technical. Yeah. But the fact that it yeah, was exactly. dragged, it became this yeah. galaxy-spanning, galaxy-changing event, I think that led to yeah. a disappointment. I think it was all a matter of scale.
I think so. Like, I mean, you think of Voyager's Time and Again,
yeah,
where they go to a planet and they find mm-hmm. out that everything's going to blow up. You know, that kind of story, it could have been that type of story. And I think it would have been very creative. And my reaction would have been completely different. It's because there's all this buildup and there's yeah. this bigger mystery. And it is the actual reason that the Federation is in shambles, to find out that it's just this one mm-hmm. thing. Yeah.
And if you, or even a two-parter, if you really wanted to have a big, mm-hmm. you know, plot that allowed it to be a Saru exercise, if you wanted mm-hmm. to let Doug be out of makeup for extended time, if you wanted to let Adira yeah. and Gray be part of it, I mean, I've got no problem with mm-hmm. any of that. And if you wanted to let that have time to resonate, if you wanted to get in and wallow in all these pieces and have the two-parter, that's fine. It's just those four or five, six setup episodes before it that I think mm-hmm. caused a lot of people to feel that they'd been cheated.
I think so. Yeah, yeah. Because like I'm saying, purely from a storytelling point of view, mm-hmm. the idea is fine. And I would be perfectly willing to accept it and let someone tell me that, no, there is science behind it. You know, it's tenuous science, but there is some kind of science behind it. I would be fine with that if it weren't the payoff for the entire season. So yeah, I think that does color it a bit. Now, again, from a storytelling point of view, if you're looking at it as, and this is in part what I think it is a story for Saru's character development. And I think it's going to roll over into season four, probably, because he has now taken Sukal back to Kaminar. Mm-hmm. He's going to nurture him.
Well, obviously, yes.
That's also, you know, that's also fine. Like, it is mm-hmm. an important story for Saru's character, and it makes sense for Saru's character. But crossing it over to be the ultimate cause of the burn, that was a bit odd. And the other thing there, too, well, you talk about having Doug out of makeup. That was brilliant. I mean, mm-hmm. Having the different characters be different races, like having mm-hmm. Culber be Bajoran, having Doug be out of makeup, it was a little bit odd at first, but it is explained in the program by one of the holograms that, you know, we don't want to scare him, so we're making you guys look the way he might think you would look. I think the biggest reason for it may have been they wanted to get Doug out of the makeup for two episodes, which I'm all on board with because yeah. I thought it was brilliant. And I love watching him act. He's such an amazing actor. Mm-hmm. And that part of the story was really wonderful. And visually, you know, that two-parter also was really beautiful at the end.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing, and
the fact they shot that in an abandoned prison, it was amazing. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And if we shift gears then and talk about the Gray and Adira Tall and Culber and Stamets and this other storyline that was running through the season of gender identity and transgender character and non-binary character.
Just broadening the representation on screen. Right.
Right. Broadening representation, acceptance, how people use their pronouns. And also found families is how I look at mm-hmm. it too, because you have very much Adira and Stamets really come together. And because Stamets and Culber are partners, you form this family, especially by the end, once Gray comes back, you've kind of formed this family of Culber and Stamets and Adira and Gray. And so there's this, and even Sukal plays into that as well, because mm-hmm. Sukal has finally been rescued. And also Saru has found Sukal, found another Kelpian who he can get together with. So there's that thing running through, which I think is a really wonderful storyline. And I think all the actors did a beautiful job mm-hmm. of portraying it.
And again, who knew how that would resonate exponentially in the pandemic?
In the pandemic.
The pandemic
yeah,
just
exactly.
added its own layer on top of all these stories, but that one especially. But yeah. yes. And I'll say yeah, selfishly, exactly. planet-wise, again, the way that the Gray and Adira in developing everything you just said, the trans representation, the feeling about mm-hmm. family and all that, but how they used a good old Trill story to mm-hmm. illustrate that was awesome. But selfishly, in the meantime, we got a great update on Trill and what's going on and looking at, you know, and getting some more traditional Trill, is it or is it not, is kind of a question. But looking at some more ways mm-hmm. that the Trill mysticism, like Vulcan mysticism, how that works out. And their ceremonies and rituals and comparing it back and forth mm-hmm. to facets and all the things that we saw through Jadzia. I really loved that episode. And I know a lot of people really mm-hmm. loved it for the representational issues, the gender, you know, equality and normative issues. But all of that, yes. And the fact that it was Trill was just icing. And not that you've never heard me going on about Trills before, but I just always thought that was one of the great unexamined cultures that were out there. And to think that we're going to do mm-hmm. our first big update with Trill in the middle of the 32nd century on Discovery Season 3 was kind of amazing and exciting. And again, I that parade of planet catch-up shows, I loved. Anyway, mm-hmm. back to representation matters.
Well, the Trill are the perfect choice to do the representation story because of the fact that they inhabit bodies of different mm-hmm. genders
they're
over
already
hundreds
blurring
of years,
lines.
So they have that experience.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. So they're the perfect ones to do that. You know, another interesting race to maybe do something like that with would be the Andorians because mm-hmm. they have four genders, mm-hmm. which has never been talked about much on the show, but it has in the literature.
And will we ever see Denobulans again or find out what happened to them?
You know, I was thinking about that a couple mm-hmm. of days ago when I was out doing my daily walk. And I was thinking, it's interesting that we haven't seen any Denobulans yet in Discovery.
Even in
Lower
Decks.
Are they going to pop up again?
Yeah. Maybe season two for Lower Decks. But see, this touches on something else that's been awesome about. I mean, we laughed about this all through Lower Decks, but they actually did it with rubber and not rubber, the latest silicone makeup techniques. But one thing that Discovery did was, and we saw it, we got excited early on, right? When the attacking mercenaries take on Burnham and Book, did we see there's the Cardassians? We see Lurians, mm-hmm. you know, aside from mm-hmm. Andorians and Orions, that makes up a major threat of the season. But we see they're going back and pulling aliens out of the background and we saw this was amazing. The hologram of the we haven't talked about this yet. The whole quantum universe spanning Kelvin universe to the right. It was a Betelgeusean. It was only one of those background characters they made up for the motion picture and were so bad they never used them close up, really.
Yeah.
They kept going back and pulling, they've been pulling aliens out of the motion picture to use. And I just love the way they're somebody. I haven't had a chance to track it down yet, but somebody, it's one thing to catalog when we see them, but I want to know who's making those decisions and who's being allowed to make those decisions and who's coming up with the creativity, you know, oh, let's go do this. And who knows whether they were a kid and grew up with all this or whether they're sitting down right now and, I don't know, looking at Memory Alpha and just going down the list and checkmarking things. Let's do that one, that one, that one, and that one. Whatever the reason, I think it's awesome. They're bringing these things to life and fleshing them out that we never had before.
I think like you and many people who read and read and read and memorized the Star Trek technical manual, whoever that person is, they read and read and read and memorized that Worlds of the Federation book that had all the aliens, so one per page, and gave you the details. Well, and so they remember all of
the 1986, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the alien that's chasing Book early in the season is also a Betelgeusean.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I was wondering, you know, like what kind of alien is that? So they really like the Betelgeuseans. They've come in quite a bit. But so one reason I bring up this found family element as we're talking about the final two episodes and what's going on with Sukal, and as all that's being figured out, there's this really nice conversation in there with Culber, and Adira's there, and Gray comes in, and I was watching that, and then within the context of everything else that's going on at the end, and then the fact that we've got so much focus on this Kelpian child who got scared and screamed and destroyed all the dilithium, and I was thinking that the representation storyline that was part of season three, I feel like they only scratched the surface of what they could have done with that story because they had all this other stuff going on. And I was a bit disappointed at the end when we had all this focus on rescuing the Kelpian child. And there was this other thing, this other storyline about representation that was there. And they were talking about it, but not enough. And so they're focusing on this. And then they've got the whole action scene of the TARDIS-style turbo lift area of Discovery that's like bigger than the ship, you know?
Okay, well, there we go.
They've also got the Osira thing where they fell back into the cardboard cookie cutter Star Trek ending, like we got an Insurrection and we got Nemesis. We get this like same ending over and over where there's always a fight between the hero and the bad guy who comes on the ship. And conveniently, the only place on the ship where things can be rebooted is in this one particular room. Like the computer, the network, nothing's networked. Apparently, you have to go to this one particular room and get trapped inside there and have a fight. You know, I felt like there was a lot of time spent on that could have been spent on some of the other storylines. So that was sort of my feeling about the finale, that most of the season I thought was quite excellent, and just kind of right at the end, we got a bit of a predictable type of ending.
Yeah, that whole sequence reminded me of, I mean, if Michael had just been able to lean back and pull out a big control rod and bang her over the head with it, it always worked for Kirk. Find the big wrench over at the side, sitting out naked alone all by itself. Talk about homages to the original series. Well, I want to say, I don't want to interrupt your flow here, but there's real, I think I was kind of shocked. There was a moment watching the entire season go by for me. And we haven't talked really about the whole Federation. We talked about the whole Federation shrinking, but at the expense of this emerald chain, like Orion's on steroids, filling in the vacuum of a shrinking Federation in the wake of the burn. And what that was, and how for a long time, as you got little seeds of that, as you got the threads of the story in Osira and her henchmen, and yes, Wren the Andorian, who I love the people that said his antenna's chopped off. It should have grown back. And I go, what if she's so mean she treated his antenna stub where it wouldn't grow back? And then that people go, oh, okay. It's like, that's the first thing I thought of was like, oh, that's how
which
symbolic
certainly
that is.
Quite probable, actually.
Oh, yeah, yes, exactly. But yeah. I was delighted that after all these kind of talk about cardboard, you know, the tropes of Star Trek or anything, the fact that she had been the cardboard villain all along until this amazing scene on two levels. One, it was an amazing mm-hmm. scene in the penultimate, right? Where she and Vance are having their big confab and she starts yeah. making sense and she starts two things. She starts making sense. She sounds rational. You start to think maybe I've misjudged her, if not her, at least them, the Emerald Chain. It's not just Orion goons and whoever they've, you know, what she's talking about, a Congress or a government and how they feel and how they feel aggrieved. And you could say it's like they're like the Gorns in Arena or something, like they maybe they have some points that you could reach out and you mm-hmm. could certainly have a negotiation with and you could certainly feel like you could trust that. And the whole buildup of that scene feels very organic and natural, and it totally turns your expectations on its side. And mm-hmm. you totally am sitting there thinking, oh my God, I'm watching a Star Trek moment. I'm about to watch Kirk say, no, I won't kill you today. I'm about to watch some mm-hmm. shocking, you know, early day I'm about to watch the Aminians and the Vendicarans be thrown out of their computer war. Something's going to happen here that's going to be totally uprooting, on the par with finding out a kid screamed and that caused the burn. A very special kid in a very special place, you know, but I'm about to see something totally unexpected and disrupting the disrupted. And of that entire scene, as I was watching that, watching both the television writing aspect of it and also watching what it was doing for Star Trek and the background of the show, then on the level of this series right now, speaking to this world, the moment, this rang out to me like I don't remember a single line in Star Trek. Everybody hearing me say this now? Because I don't go into that shippy stuff or a lot of the background here, the heart and soul of things. I love it. I take it for granted. But this is one thing mm-hmm. that totally gobsmacked me. When she gets to the point where she says, fine, let's negotiate it. And he's like, and Vance is, well, I can't deal with you. Nobody's going to trust you. Nobody on our side is going to trust you. She's like, what's wrong? He says, well, you've mm-hmm. murdered people. You've assaulted planets. You've still got people in captivity. And she goes, I'm going to change. I'm going to change. And he says, fine. Your people can change, but you're too far gone. Mm-hmm. And she says, oh, come on. Forget that. We're trying to move into the future here. Don't be held back by the past. And Vance mm-hmm. says this line that I literally fell out of my chair almost. The past is the light by which we illuminate the future. And mm-hmm. I thought, my God, for everyone that says, okay, yeah, some bad stuff has happened in the past. Let's just move on. Like, hey, I know that, mm-hmm. but you know, if we dwell on the past too long, we're not yeah. moving forward. And it's no. Those who ignore the past, you know, those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. But this is even more right. organic, and it speaks to so much today. We cannot, you know, they mm-hmm. have some countries where they had this reckoning. I don't think the Germans more or less lived through this, but a lot of nations and societies since have had truth and reconciliation commissions where they basically get mm-hmm. their dirty laundry. Said, boy, did we screw up as a society, or half of our society really screwed up, caused pain for our people, maybe our neighbors, maybe the entire world. We know we mm-hmm. can't move on with trust and character until we get all of our dirty laundry out in the open. We talk about it. We don't cover anything up. We admit it. And then we do move on. Because if we try to move on without doing that, outsiders will suspect us. We will suspect ourselves. We will suspect our former adversaries, right? I mean, even in mm-hmm. Living Witness and Voyager, you saw kind of this playing out in the three acts of Living Witness when the old history of the Voyager was being misinterpreted. And then when they tried to reinterpret it, the factions were still there. And we saw the three factions on Navarre doing this. But the fact that he stands up and says that the past is the light that we illuminate the future, it speaks to so much of today's world. The politics and the culture issues that are going on right now as we try to move forward and still have things hanging back, and the people won't mm-hmm. look at the immediate past, much less the far past, to move forward. And I just thought that was awesome. And I was so full of love for this episode on that round, what they were doing as a storyteller, and then that one line speaking good old Star Trek truth to emulate the thing. And then the next episode, it was all back to the cardboard villains having the fight again.
Right.
And all of that went out the window. But for Chris, for one brief shining moment, I saw the best. I just raved about that episode. And then I didn't want to be too crushed. So I just enjoyed raving about that scene in that episode for a while. I don't mind telling the world. I was sitting there going, wow, I've never been so struck by a single line in an episode. You know, I can finally get on that train. People have been doing that for decades. And I'd never really had that happen until that moment. But I just thought this is so perfectly Star Trek speaking to our times.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that kind of commentary is why I love Deep Space Nine. It has that sort of deeper look at the world and situations. Mm-hmm. And so by that happening in the season of Discovery, it goes back to what you said early on in our discussion of how the writing is finding itself. The series is settling in, right? I also feel like
there is a tide.
We're getting more of what we would consider the Star Trek components of the storytelling finding their ways into the episodes compared with seasons one and two. And the thing about this is that, say, the face-off between Osiris and the Orions and Vance and the Federation, she doesn't have to die at the end of this season because there's no cliffhanger at the end of season three like we've had before.
Mm-hmm.
This time, they're going out to help start rebuilding the Federation. So that discussion that they are having could have been continued into the fourth season between Vance and Osiris, between those sides, which is why it's even more frustrating that she does end up dying in the cookie cutter fight at the end, like you would get at the end of a movie or something where there's no reason for the villain to continue on. So why don't we just have a fight and, you know, kick them down a bottomless pit inside the ship or something like that? So it would have been nice if they had carried that forward.
That's another problem with these short season, you know, arcs. I mean, it happened with the older series too, but they really get in this habit of thinking, you know, season, and there is some carryover.
Yeah.
Right. But to fall in that trap of like wrap up this arc and the people associated with it, you know, we'll never see them again.
Yeah.
And 90% of the time that's happened when some of these they created some incredible characters here and had some great actors, you know, pulling those characters off incredibly.
Right. And that's what I was thinking about earlier today as well, when I was thinking about the fact that I'm disappointed that they didn't do more with the Adira, Gray, Stamets, Culber story. I'm pretty sure, you probably know for sure, they have said that Adira is continuing on in season four, I believe. Right?
Oh, yeah. They've all spoken about it. Right.
They'll be part. So hopefully they will continue to tell this story and grow this story in season four. Because I was thinking that this is the type of story that would be perfectly transplanted to DS9 or to Enterprise, especially to DS9, where over the course of three or four or five seasons, you start to tell this story because this found family that I was talking about earlier can grow if you let them grow from season to season. And when you have these short seasons, you have less opportunity to tell these stories. So more than ever, you need to carry this over from season to season. And if you don't, then the viewer starts to feel shortchanged because it feels like you superficially touch on a lot of topics, but you don't delve into them.
Well, it's kind of like it's a structure of the storytelling that you don't intend, but that's what happens. It's like my old joke about all the Berman era shows with stardates that very nicely, very, very succinctly and by the book had a 1,000-year stardate and they ran through the season, which meant that if the stardate year, which it did, they did memos on this, you know, Mike's system was January 1 was stardate zeros, you know, the last three digits, right? The first two were the year in a way, but the last three were the within the year. So it's a 1,000-year stardate, which makes no sense. Basically, every day, 24-hour day, is three stardate units going by, kind of ish. But you would get the cliffhangers, right? Would all be at stardate, I don't know, 67998 and 67999. And then the new season would start with the opening premiere and the star date would be 68001, you know. But if you stop and think about it, it's like all these galaxy spanning events are happening all during the Terran holidays, the Western Terran holidays. Like, wow, nobody ever had no Starfleet officer from Earth that still observed any Western cultural traditions ever had any fun over their holidays. all the big crises always happened over the old school holidays. What a bummer. You know, like,
Wolf 359, have to work on the holidays.
The Klingon Civil War. We have to go do a detector net for Romulans on the neutral zone. Oh, crap. There goes my holiday.
Mars gets attacked on first contact day.
Yeah, So it's a tradition. Anyway, but that was like the unintended. It's like if you pull that out and go with it, unless you want to say that no one observes holidays anymore. Okay, fine. But I much prefer to think about just how bad the holidays were for those who observed through the 2360s and 70s. You know, it was a rough time.
Right.
Why is it ever happens in August?
Right. Oh, so related to using the time you have available in a short season to tell the stories that you need to tell in a way that's satisfying for the viewer. One other thing I wanted to talk about was the whole Terra Firma two-parter in the middle of the season.
Yes.
So you have 13 episodes and you decide that you're going to use two of the episodes to return a character back to the past so that you can do
somewhere.
A TV show with them that you were already planning to do, because for some reason you brought that character to the future when you should have left them back there in the first place, knowing that you have a spinoff series in the works. And you use two
owe her a
of
paycheck,
your episodes.
Chris, we signed a contract. We owe her a paycheck.
Okay. So, of course, you know, thinking of it in terms of business and how it works, yes, having her as such a star on the show, and it's a great character.
Right. Beloved actress, beloved character.
So, of course, you want to have Michelle Yeoh on your show. And her moments in the season were wonderful. And I especially love when she blinks at the holograms so that they go away. I loved that. And I was also thinking, I've actually thought about this whole situation quite a bit, which maybe says something weird about me, but I think
you have
that
had
if it were
some
me
experience
writing,
with the eyes and all things ocular.
With the eyes, yeah.
So,
that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I did get frustrated with these two episodes for a couple of reasons. One is that I'm not a big fan of the Mirror Universe in the first place.
Yeah.
As you know, I think the inclusion of the Mirror Universe in the first season was born in part of them not quite knowing what to do with the season, because they kind of got to the middle and it was like, what are we going to do? How about let's go to the Mirror Universe?
That's cool. People love Mirror Universe. You know? Let's do that. Yeah.
And
yes.
And of course, we did get this great character of Emperor Georgiou coming over, and now you've got her here, so what are you going to do with her? So calling back to that with her, of course it made sense, but it also meant that in the middle of this pursuit for what caused the burn and the conversation about transgender rights and identity and the found family stuff that I've been talking about, as well as the growth of the other characters and the fact that finally, they're actually keeping the bridge crew involved in the stories.
Well, they're putting a camera
on
them,
an ongoing
much less
basis.
Keeping them involved. Yes, yes.
You know, they're finally doing that. And then we stop to have two episodes in the Mirror Universe so that we can ultimately get Georgiou out of the 32nd century. That was really the whole point, right? To get her out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are elements of the episodes that I really like. I loved The Guardian of Forever. I thought that was really fun to see.
Yeah. How amazing is it to figure out that The Guardian of Forever could pick itself up and become a refugee? I mean, that's...
Well, it's the future, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But for The Guardian of Forever, time has no meaning, right?
Time has no meaning, right. And, you know, it's obviously The Guardian of Forever was... could, if not composed originally... was drawing on its own programmable matter there. I mean, that was like, true, who cares? Right? It's all doable now. It's kind of like the Kelvin universe. It's all fine. Just make up a reason and go with it. It's fine. It's 1,000 years in the future, but there are no rules.
Yeah. But I thought it was fun. And I thought, I don't know if they did this intentionally, but trying to like throw you off at first, like, is it the Guardian of Forever? I think a lot of us thought
it Khan?
First. Okay, it's either, is it either the Guardian of Forever or is it Q?
Right, right.
And when
right.
he says my name's Carl, Q, Carl, you think, okay, maybe that's like a Q's joking. Haha, I'm Carl. And because he's reading the newspaper and it reminded me like in Death Wish on mm-hmm. Voyager when they mm-hmm. go into the continuum and the guy's like reading the newspaper.
Right.
It kind of had that feeling to it. And I thought it was quite well done. And then he
sat in the chair, brought forever. The paper. We've all done it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed all that. And I will also say, though,
and that the headlines, when you finally got close up clips of the headlines, they're all throwaway, exactly. References to most of them are references to all Guardian of Forever type references and Sitting on the Edge of Forever type.
Right.
So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So I will say, though, that the episodes were well done as character development episodes for Georgiou, particularly, it was a stark contrast seeing her in the Mirror Universe environment. Now, compared with when we met her in season one,
right. And you could see all just by the book
how then. Her, you could see how her time in the prime timeline, being around Michael, being around Saru, I think especially, and these other crew members, have really affected how she thinks. And she still puts on that act like, I'm really nasty and I don't care. But maybe she really does a bit.
Well, Chris, hold on to your chair. Just think. They're actually using the Mirror Universe for what it was created for. They're using the Mirror Universe for its first best destiny, which is to be a contrast with the Prime Universe, like in Mirror Mirror yes. throughout DS9. Yes. I mean, one time we didn't was on Enterprise, and that was just a ton of fun. That worked. But the right. Mirror Universe has no point unless you come back again and you go, oh, this is all different from our real world. I mean, it started with Mirror Mirror, right? So it's what are they doing on my ship? I mean, seeing Georgiou's changes, because look, there was a faction of fandom that ran around all year long going, why did they bring her with them? Not just why did they bring her, but like, she is a war criminal. She's like a Hitler or a Stalin or a Pol Pot. She has like murdered millions. And why are they bopping her? Why is she allowed to roam the ship free? They can't trust her. I mean, there was a lot of that residual. Sure, she has a quip every now and then, but is that worth the trust, the risk of letting her run around loose? So that part of her send off here for a lot of that lingering feeling. I mean, I understand that feeling, too. I mean, yes, you can't. Again, the past is the light we illuminate the future. You can't just erase all of her war crimes. But to see her back in her old digs, and of course, that wasn't reality. That was the Guardian Forever making. That was like watching the alternate Edith Keeler newspaper where she met with FDR and it delayed entry, and the Germans won and yada, yada. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't, it's not like we're, anybody who sat down and was trying to peg the Mirror Universe, the Terran Empire in Terra Firma, it's an exercise in silliness because that's not actual canon flying by. And they're violating what we know to have happened already. Michael is alive still, on down the line.
Right.
The function of the whole point was to show us, as well as show her herself, how much she had changed and to make peace with it. Because those fans who were griping about her being on Discovery, if she's actually going to spin off and lead a show, a series, that's not completely, clinging to the dark side, she's got to be heroic enough as she leads that show. Mm-hmm. She's got to have outgrown her old self, too. And they've given her this crazy, complicated backstory. So, it was like a cleanse before they send her off into her own world.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And in that sense, there's a lot of value in the episodes.
Oh, yeah.
But back to my original point about them being in the middle of the season is that would you have maybe done that as one episode instead of two, for example?
Yeah.
So that you have more time for the other plot lines that are running through the season.
it's kind of like Ira talking about having the Klingon War thrown at them to have to deal with in Worf's arrival, yeah. right when they're ramping up the Dominion right. War. It's like having to take a detour over here to deal with this thing thrown at mm-hmm. us artificially. Mm-hmm. The artificial thing being, we're so happy for you having your own series, Michelle, but now we have to stop ours to get you out of here. Well, you
to
know,
get you out of here. Yeah.
There was a, it wasn't the entirety of both hours. I mean, there was a B plot. There was a split plot going on. They were still pursuing the burn and the mystery.
Right.
I mean, they were pursuing that. So, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of talk these days about being able to walk and chew gum at the same time, or maybe even a third thing. So the fact that in hindsight, maybe if they rearranged time of possession here, who's got the ball? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Who's got the plot? Who's got the arc carrying it? And if there'd been a little less for that and a little more for some of the other arcs going by, maybe so. But in the end, I didn't mind. I know it wasn't a part of it, but the build up to the Guardian Forever confrontation with, and they're even talking about being on the boundary of the Gamma Quadrant, I think. One of the other quadrants. I was like, wow, they're really bopping around and using their universe. Mm-hmm. Hashtag. Yeah. I enjoyed, well, especially part one.
And see, for me, I think in hindsight, looking back at it, I see more value in it than I did at the time mm-hmm. that I'm watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the time I'm watching it, I really feel the disruption in the storyline. Like, okay, wow, we're going to do Mirror Universe for two episodes now. I want to keep going with this other thing.
Be patient, little boy. And, be patient. It's going to be okay.
But when I look back at it after everything's played out, uh-huh. then I can focus more on the character development aspect of it.
Mm-hmm,
and you know, what you say about the cleansing, I think is really interesting and really important as a setup for her own show.
Cool. Because that just came to me as I was, it was coming out of my mouth.
Well, I hadn't thought about that myself either. I had thought about they're developing her character a bit more mm-hmm. because, you know, we need to do that because she's going to have her own show. But the extent to which they would be cleansing the character, preparing it, and also adding depth to the character. But mm-hmm. but I guess more than anything, showing the growth that the character has gone through so that they can then leverage that and build upon it mm-hmm. in a new show, which hopefully they will. Of course, we don't know if they will. They might make the new show might be completely different, and they might just play up on her bad elements as the Mirror Universe Empress, but I don't know. But no, that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting.
You know, and I said, it had just occurred to me to put it in these terms, but if, and I think for all the chaff they take, I think the writers, they're all very diverse people. Everybody's on social media now. They can see what fan sentiments are. They could see that the world went crazy over Anson Mount. They could see mm-hmm. that they would be fools not to get a Strange New Worlds in production and use him and the characters with him and get that going, even though they'd announced Section 31 first. They could see they should strike while the iron's hot and go with that goodwill. And it's, you know, it's not just being nice to fans. It's like, let's go make some money. Yeah, you know, it's everything. Mm-hmm. Everybody's rowing the same direction, which is great. And I think they could see, they knew that in their own storytelling, character telling guts, they knew that this character still had a lot of black cloud hanging over from her deeds in the Mirror Universe. They knew that. And the entire, you know, but it's like the season two with the chase for the, you know, the Red Angel and the angel suit and all of that and the mystery of this, that, and the other and the whole, and the war with Section 31 in control and all of that. And the fact that she was over there. So not only is she Terran, now she's working for Section 31. And the fact that that made sense. And oh, well, there she goes. How is she going to fit into this world now, this universe? And mm-hmm. the fact that she wound up not being able to, you know, she couldn't live there. You would think that was where she would find a niche and be helpful and be devious and murderous and all of that. But that was too much for her, or that didn't fit. She came back to Discovery. She turned against, you know, it was a corrupted Section 31. I mean, people tend to lump it all together. But, you know, but control and the AI out of control and all of that. She didn't like that either. She liked being in control of her own body. Thank you. She wasn't going to be a minion to an AI. So we've already seen, even when we didn't, there were 15 things going on at once. And I was going, why? You know, the one thing that happened as the season went from one to two and she's hanging around and she's hanging around. And then we get into that conflict. she has a soft spot for Burnham, which is weird because you would think that Michael would have the soft spot for her, which she did because she can't get her original, her old Captain Georgiou out of her mind. Mm-hmm. And we didn't see the mirror Georgiou with Michael much. So we don't have as much. Well, we barely saw 2 hours of the other two, but you know, they're counterparts, they're doppelgangers. But it right. says something that there was a bond between them. And the only thing you can hang anything that happened on season two, much less season three, increasingly, is knowing that the weirdness affinity that Michael insisted on showing her, she shows to Michael, and it was mutual. And they would abuse each other at times of that, but they would always come back to it. So in this weird 15 arc level serialized 10 episode, 13 episode season that we're now looking at Star Trek to, the more I talk about this, the more I'm kind of, it's remarkable that this hung together. And yet those writers were exactly up with the fan base that was still saying, whoa, wait a minute. Just because she has a soft spot in her heart for Michael, they let her run around the ship and she hasn't killed everybody yet. We still have some questions. And I think the writers knew that. And I think they say, well, if this much of fandom is saying this now, what? And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure that Bui and Erica had been, they'd been working on this for 2 years. I'm sure that they have grappled with that notion long, long ago. And maybe exactly how to get her there to where enough of fandom is going to trust that character and think it's worthwhile, or not even watch mm-hmm. the show because they think it's going to be grim and dark and unrelentingly, you know, mean-spirited. Or maybe we're going to see a slow turn on the series. But if I thought that the Vulcan Hello and Battle of the Binaries was dark starting out, you know, in context as for Kings was a long haul to go from darkness to light. Why am I going to take a chance with this mass murdering war criminal in Section 31? Why would I ever want to watch that show? So I think they've been dealing with that for a long time. A part of fandom has been thinking about it increasingly more so, increasingly with the jump. So, you know, I think there's a lot of gears here and wheels that are all spinning at once. And eventually we're going to find out how long they've been thinking about exactly what to do. And maybe they had still no head. I'm going to be really curious to figure out when they decided they're going to spin her off. And then what did the pandemic and slowing down the schedules do to that timing and the plans and, you know, all of that kind of thing. It's right. going to be really fascinating to get to that. Well, but I now looking, as you say, now in hindsight, it's like, it had to happen. It had to happen or else the new show was going to be doomed or doomed to a tiny fan base of, you know, masochists and and sadists and people that get off or on. Dark hearts.
Maybe not that. Maybe just people who are more interested in, you know, like crime dramas, those types of shows would be more interested in. That's how I was originally really thinking about the Section 31 as being more like, you know, the CSI kind of show, that type of thing rather than Star Trek.
It would have to have legs and be Star Trek, and it couldn't be the worst of the bunch. But then you've got her. So, right. How are you even going to get her to where it's more of a fun show? A sarcastically dark-humored show, maybe, whatever. But how is she going to get there to be comfortable lead with Star Trek being the brand name at the top of it all?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The fact that she has this soft spot for Burnham, it doesn't feel too odd to me because it's just that like mother-child relationship that, you know, maybe they...
It's not really like, her. Really,
no, but I know it's...
And it's both ways. Well, yeah.
Yeah, I know. But that's what's interesting is like they're making the point that even though it's not really... They're from different universes, but they're in some way, you know, you could get into the whole multiverse theory where like we each exist in infinite number and somehow through quantum streams we're connected in some way, kind of like that. So
don't be so limited, Larry. Don't be so limited by mere quantum streams.
So I don't know. I can see the fact that, you know, she lost her Michael, so she has a soft spot for this Michael for some reason that doesn't make any sense to any of us, but to her it does. Or maybe it doesn't even make sense to her. It's just something she feels and she can't help it.
Part of the aggravation is that she feels it, and she's mad at herself for feeling it, but she can't get away from it.
Well, that's sort of how Michelle Yeoh plays the character, actually. Mm-hmm. That's the point, yeah. So I guess to wrap up the conversation about her, I said a while ago that I was thinking that if it were me writing, I would have never brought her along in the first place, knowing that I need to put her in this other show. Of course, now that we've talked about the character development, I think it was a good move to bring her and do this, even though it took up two episodes of our 13.
Yes, her cleanse. That's our official word now.
But the other thing, even before we talked, when I think about the fact that I probably wouldn't have brought her, I do love the moments that she has in the season. And there are some important moments. I mean, she gets them out. The whole thing with Saru and Tilly, they would have died if it weren't for her. Because Saru, even though I love Saru and I think that he really embodies all the Star Trek ideals, he also embodies the naivety of the original Star Trek vision, which is that the world can be black and white, and you can just say, this is what's right, and this is what's good, and you can always adhere to it. And in the real world, you can't do that, which is where DS9 excels in showing that the world is shades of gray.
And I had not thought about this until now. Maybe somebody was way ahead of me on this 2 and 3 years ago, but it just dawned on me, Saru, even, and he's come a long way, especially since he lost the danger field. I've gone blank on the name. His feelers.
His ganglia.
Thank you.
His feelers.
I'm feeling the danger.
His danger feelers.
Danger. And now it's time for danger feeler. especially since he had that growth. But even so, overall, Saru is a lot like, and we saw that happening his naivete got him in trouble this year, this last season.
Yeah. Still, several times.
But, it's almost like, though, he's maybe a little more mature version, but it's like he's the good Kirk in the transporter accident of Enemy Within. Because the whole moral of that is we all need our dark. Yeah. We need all of ourselves, not just the good, because the good, the bad is the part of us that's simplification.
Right.
But to take a risk, not to play it safe, all of that.
But, yeah, that's a really good analogy, although...
Well, it's very simple, but...
Kirk in that situation becomes weak because he doesn't have any of that fear or bad side to draw upon. Saru is not weak, actually, but he's naive.
Mm-hmm.
And he has trouble sensing when he should not do something by the book. And Georgiou bailed him out on multiple occasions this season. And so if they had not brought her... They, of course, could have written the story so that Saru and Tilly get out. Of course, they could do that. But the story that we saw would have certainly been different if Georgiou had not been there to just push Saru to just take action instead of trying to be the perfect Starfleet Academy graduate.
Well, it would have been Michael doing it, but they were so busy trying to instill Michael with this. I was off my own for a year. And I'm with Book, and I'm different. It got to be a little redundant to hear her one more time say, "But I had a year alone, and I can't go with you now."
Yeah.
But by the end of the year, that's exactly where she was. So to your point, if they hadn't had Georgiou around to do that, then heaven forbid it would have had to been somebody else from the ship. They might have let one of the bridge officers get dark on her. They might have used, you know, Jet Reno, or they might have used...
Jet Reno is what I was thinking.
Yeah. Or Non, or somebody would have had to have been there to go, you know, or maybe Stamets on a bad day, or somebody would have been there to kind of reinforce him. But it worked the way it did, because it worked the way it
well,
did.
Well, I mean, Jet Reno could have reinforced him with duct tape, of course.
I so wanted her to say bailing wire and duct tape and just be totally, because that was my, that was our phrase. That was my grandpa. Yeah. Bailing wire and duct tape.
I wish she had more moments on the show. Because one of my favorite lines from the season is when she tells Stamets, like, you know, way to go, Bobcat. Culver's like, Bobcat? I don't know. I'm on drugs. And it's just such a throwaway line. It's
just
so
a
funny.
Random thing, yeah. Well, damn it, Tig DeSoto's actually got a life and a career, and she doesn't have time to hang around Toronto trying to wait for the scenes to be filmed. So, yeah.
Yeah.
She's not quite to the Whoopi level, the Whoopi Goldberg level of you have to write a scene for me when I can come to your show. She's not quite there, but she's on the path. So, yay.
Okay. Well, I guess we've talked enough about Georgia and we'll see where she goes. I guess ultimately I'm glad that they brought her and she had her moments through the season. Mm-hmm. And it also allowed them to expand the universe a bit, as we always talk about, by explaining that during this 1,000 years, the humans in our universe have actually been studying the Terrans. Like, they know all about, they've broken right. down the Terran genome and like all this kind of stuff. That was adding texture that was interesting.
Well, the Kelvin universe, the Terran, the mirror universe. I mean, it's like are there no secrets anymore? Well, apparently what caused the burn was a big secret. But it's
that's the only secret, Larry. That's the only secret in the 30th century.
And how to reunite these emerald chain guys. Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to know, the other big mystery is I want to know how Osira got Daft Punk to work for her. I guess, it's even bigger now because Daft Punk broke up. So somehow she got them back together and then got them to work as her bodyguards.
Some things were just, that's actually, I didn't want to bring this up because, you know, I've had things shared with me that I could be shot for saying, Chris, but that's actually one of the major arcs of season 4 is
the whole Daft Punk.
Yeah. Osiris is gone, but we're going to follow her bodyguards. Yeah. But speaking of that,
Larry, that's a spinoff series. That's another spinoff series that's coming to MTV.
Hasn't been announced
yet, but
I just wrote a whole episode, all 4 minutes long for Sci-Fi 5 about backdoor pilots featuring Assignment Earth. But I'm just sitting here thinking, we kind of had a backdoor pilot. That was basically a backdoor pilot for Georgiou there. And now we're going to have the backdoor pilot for the Osira security detail.
Exactly.
Going on 30-second recreation band tours of Daft Punk. Yeah.
People were shocked. Was it two weeks ago when Daft Punk announced that they're splitting? People were shocked. But now we know the real reason. They've got a deal with CBS Viacom, Paramount Plus, MTV for a spinoff series, Off the Emerald Chain.
You heard it here first, folks. They got a piece of the mountain.
They're hanging out up there on the top of the mountain. All right. Okay, so
can I say one thing also, speaking of wrap-ups here, before that one line blew me away later on, so I could be disappointed show later, although I was determined not to let the power of the one line elude me. I still hang on to that, which is great. I love applying it to everyday situations. There was an episode earlier in the year that as I was enjoying a lot of these, and again, they all had like, there's the Trill show, there's the Vulcan show, there's the Earth show with the secret outer colonists they'd lost track of within 100 years. There's another episode that I really felt, I was kind of amazed. It was a standalone, but I was amazed at how packed it was. And that was the episode Die Trying, which had an interesting, but it has the whole non-subplot and she's booted off the show and given this thing. But the whole thing with her people and the seed pod ship. And meanwhile, and it's also the one where they first, that's the spinoff of the plot where they finally find Star. First, they're finally looking for Earth. Mini Voyager getting home with an homage, yes, to Voyager and other people. But they get home. You have the huge buildup of finding, you know, they try to go to Earth. Oh, Earth's not the Earth we know. Okay, if we want fake Earth now, we have to go to the Starfleet/Federation headquarters. And I love the way they kept reminding you that there was a difference, but right now they're just using the same office space because rent is expensive. You know, and the fact that half the show is them getting there and you think that's enough and getting up to speed and not being the whole plot of them not being trusted. And they're kind of pissed that they're not being trusted. But I, as an audience member, go, well, of course they're not going to trust you. Come on, guys. And then you gradually find about how under the gun they are. Right. You find out why they would normally be. They would not be doing their jobs if they didn't distrust who this 1,000-year-old ship just pops up to be. I mean, that's right. You know, it's hardly, you know, Morgan Bateson or something, but hardly Kelsey Grammer there. But then they have enough room carved out of this episode left over to do the whole non in the seeds thing, you know, with the Barzans and the poignant story of that. And the fact that it, to me anyway, it actually was a mystery until they got to, I mean, I kind of figured where it was going, But for a lot part of that arc, it really was well constructed and merged. And it didn't feel like it was crammed. It felt like there was room for both to breathe. And then they do kind of knit them up at the end with a confrontation at the end. And she has an emotional moment and it was paid off and she's off the show, we think. But it wasn't a cheap exit. It was really heartfelt. I thought she had a good, you know, death scene. She didn't die, but she died from the show anyway. And when it was all over, I was like, wow, they really did a good job of cramming. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. There was like a lot of story packed into that hour and a lot of storytelling got done. I almost wondered if those started off as two different episodes and got merged when the reality of the season layout, you know, became known. But I still think they carried it off. I just wanted to say a shout out to Die Trying, because I really thought they accomplished a lot when I might not have expected that. And I appreciated Nan's, it's sad to see her leave, but it's like, that's why she was bumped up to star status, lead status, and got residuals at the beginning, only to be, it's like, well, if you're going to get rid of me midway through, then I want star billing at the beginning. Okay. I mean, I can almost see that happening. You know, if you're going to focus on me for an episode.
And in the first episodes, you see her standing around in places like, why is she there, you know?
Why is she standing? That one scene that you see all the time because there was a still. Dr. Pollard sending somebody off and they're talking about, you know, the medical conditions and Michelle Yeoh standing there talking. And in the background, she's looking at a pad back there. Nan is back looking at a pad with a strut, like she's Captain Morgan looking at a pad. And you just think
those types of scenes get me. And it's the same with Sarah Middich as Nilsson. I just keep wondering what they're going to do with her. And I thought for a while, like maybe Saru's going to make her first officer because they've obviously kept her around. They keep giving her screen time. She doesn't say much, but they keep showing her glancing. And so I know that they've filmed more of her. And when they're cutting it, we only see her for a moment. So they must be filming more moments of her and they're getting cut. And I'm wondering, like, what are they doing with this character? Because they're obviously keeping her around for something. And I don't know when that's going to turn up, but it is interesting when people get like the higher billing and they get this screen time. And if you're watching for that, you start to notice it. If you're not watching for that, maybe you don't pay any attention, but it starts to stand out, right?
Well, so he's kind of made a name for himself. It's been amazing this past year since the show ended. But Noah Averback Katz, who was Rin, the Andorian, who's also in real life.
Well, he's Mary Wiseman's husband, right?
Yes, he's Mary Wiseman's husband.
Yeah.
And he was only in like four episodes and he dies at the end. So I think, you know, if Leonard Nimoy can say no one dies in science fiction after Star Trek III came out and people were saying, I just cheapened your death. It's like, shut up, I'm back. Who knows what could happen down the line, but it's just amazing. When we had him, I interviewed him. We had him on several of the Trek Files episodes. And I got to ask because I hadn't seen. It's like, so while you're there and you guys all, everybody knows what's going on. What you referred to, when Sarah Middich was the whole thing with Arium last year, but this year, the remaining surviving Asnulis character, who had been an actress named Ava Blackwell, was under the head. All of a sudden, the Asnulis disappeared, and all of a sudden, we have Lieutenant Ina, Ava Blackwell. She's human. It's the same thing again. No makeup head. She gets to be out with her own head. It's like, did she have an agent come in on steroids and redo her small contract to get a little bit better?
I think.
Or what happened?
There's probably an agent who specializes in getting you out of the head.
See, well, where I grew up, that was just called your mom banging on the bathroom door saying, get out of there. But anyway, get out of the head. In this case, Sarah was in a play and they wanted that extra body on the bridge. So they let Ava come out of her Osnulis wacky head and be in her human form. Mm-hmm. And suddenly she's Lieutenant Ina. But by the end of the season, Sarah was back to be Nilsson. And they want everybody. They want everybody at the end, and it's a big happy thing. But that whole arc of the bridge crew running around in the ship as the ship is dying and they're all gasping and breathing for oxygen, it's like, wow, it's a whole thing, and everybody's getting to be action heroes, and they're all having near-death scenes. And it was really wild to watch that all evolve. Like, it took 2.5 years for them to figure out, we've got these people, why don't we use them? But then to see the heads coming back and forth, and I was like, I'm sure, I bet it's something very simple. It's as simple as George going away to do the Green Berets, and they give all of his lines to Walter. Excuse me. Sulu is off being in a movie, and Chekhov gets all of his lines. It's exactly what happened, and Noah told us. He's like, yep, that's what happened. Sarah got to do a play, I think, and they wanted that body replaced, and they thought, well, let's let Ava do it. You know, we let Sarah do it last year. Let's let her do it. And then when Sarah came back, they didn't stick Ava back in the head. She got to be there, too. So and when they filmed that last scene in the new uniforms, a lot of people weren't there. They did composites and Photoshop people in. If you noticed, they did one angle when Sonequa was still pregnant, which was funny. Mm. And somebody caught the fact that the first time they shot it, Tilly has a blue stripe for science. And then she's in gold for command or vice versa. But people were catching it on, you know, and they had to go back in and Photoshop for the film, for the cuts they used on screen. Yeah. They had to go back. Anyway, it's awesome that we're, you know, thank goodness we still have little wacky little tales, you know, keeping everybody watching.
Well, the Beetlejuicean, who's from the Kelvin timeline, I believe they had the wrong badge, cum badge on him also, and they had to fix that in post. They had the, what is it, first contact onward with the kind of like the squarish bracket on him instead of the oval shaped one from earlier in the TNG. So it's nice they can fix all that stuff in post these days.
Oh, you're talking about the Betelgeusean, right?
Right, yeah. When they do, they show the holographic one, they say like, well, this was guy was...
Yeah, I won't even go there, but I sat down one day and went, now wait a minute. If he came from the Kelvin over to their universe, how did he have a next-gen uniform?
Well, see, I think that's really interesting because your first reaction is to think like, oh, they screwed this up or they screwed that up. Or even with the badge, people are like, oh, they screwed up the badge. But I'm thinking like, but we're playing with lots of multiple universes here. Yes. So who knows? Maybe he's from yet another one where these elements occurred at different times and they're mixed together. You can really start having some interesting ideas about how it all fits together.
Or he went, it was something about the timing as well, but, he was in the Kelvin, went to the Prime and came back. I realized that another answer could just be even more complex and weird and reveal, but it's obvious the fact that they are very much aware of the Kelvin timeline and they're very much aware of the Mirror Universe, the Terran timeline. So. It's a brave new world, Chris. It's a brave new world.
All right. So a last topic here, looking ahead to season 4. So at the end, we've got Discovery going off. They're going to help start to deliver, I guess, dilithium and such to planets of the Federation. They're going to try to start rebuilding the Federation a little bit.
You get some dilithium and you get some dilithium.
Yeah.
And you get some
exactly.
Dilithium.
What do you expect to see in season 4? And one bonus question I was thinking about earlier.
Ding, ding.
Do you think that they might try to figure out how to make the spore drive technology work and start refitting ships so that, I know fans who hate the spore drive will love this, you could have Starfleet ships spore jumping all over the galaxy.
They're going to double down on spore drive. Well, it makes a whole lot more sense. It's like everything. It's like it's kind of like what I would say. Well, you know, it's the Kelvin universe, so I'm not going to care a whole lot. It's like, oh, it's 1,000 years in the future, so it's okay. It's not a complete dumping ground for plot logic, but it helps because you have to chalk it up to have a plan for it, but just chalk it up to we cannot fathom. Nobody 1,000 years ago could fathom our science today. So how do we do the same thing for 1,000 years, knowing that the pace of change will be far more accelerated than it was looking back 1,000 years? So, you know what, Chris, I really don't care. It's not that I don't care. It's like, I don't have any expectation. It's like now that they're freed of the 10 years before Kirk meme, it's like they can do. I mean, they've set themselves up. Obviously, we're going to follow Saru back. We got some personal arcs going on. Like you said, we're going to expand Gray and Adira and then Stamets and Culber's family with them and the evolution of Michael is in the captain's seat now. So, okay. And the Federation is retrenching. And are there hiccups with the Emerald Chain? What, you know, we still don't know in this time frame. We saw a couple of Cardassians in the Emerald Chain, but we still don't know what the state of Romulans and Klingons and Cardassians and Ferengi and all the good old boys are, or anybody, what happened with all the Gamma and Delta Quadrant people? I mean, not to make it all a political show again, but you've got so many elements out there from the standpoint of we've barely begun to update. We saw, again, we saw Earth and Vulcan / Navarre and Trill, but we've barely heard about what's the latest from everybody else. Status report, you know, so there's all of those things to play with, and not just for the sake of canonistas, but to as building blocks for stories, both. I'm sure it's 2020. They'll come up 2021. They'll come up with some one or two long arcs. But again, they're getting better at integrating standalone stories that you can retain that mesh with the run without it being oppressive. Like, and now it's time for running arc number two, the latest, you know. So,
yeah,
I that's part of it, too, though. I'm looking forward to seeing that continued evolution of the sophistication of telling Star Trek through this modern world that we're doing with, you know, 12 or 13 episodes and that kind of storytelling that was so jarring in the beginning, but it was also partly jarring because they weren't really good at it. And plus they were turning people over every month. The teams were changing every month at the beginning, but things are settling down and, you know, and having the other shows happening, even the animated shows is giving everybody a sense of how all of this looks or can look. So I'm excited. I feel like they finally found their skin, and I feel, you know, I'm happy for all the characters. This thing with Stamets and Burnham, like, I hope it's not the token. We got to have one thing that's not happy dappy here as we end this. You know, it's like we can't have this. It's an ongoing show, so we can't just wrap up everything at the end of the season. He's got to be pissed at her for throwing him out the airlock with a rocket.
Oh, I know. Right.
And having them having him scowl at her twice, it felt like ninth grade goofiness or something there. It's kind of like he's going to like frown at her from across the room two or three times. Although, you know what? I forget the episode, but that scene when you saw almost like the PTSD of Detmer and Culber and the crew even playing out when they had the big fight in the mess hall early.
Yeah,
that was really some interesting stuff. Because
you mean the one when Saru had dinner with everyone?
Right. And he started off.
Detmer was talking about Stamets's blood, and
it was Zora's great idea. Remember? So there we go. But when he had the dinner, and everybody winds up blowing up and walking away like a bad Thanksgiving dinner,
right?
That was really kind of, it was a little moment, and you'd almost think it was kind of on the nose and tokenish. Like, we need some drama here. We got to scare up some inner character problems.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I kept trying to remember the last time we saw, you know, okay, so maybe somebody does that once a show in DS9. But it wasn't everybody on everybody. It was like one person having a fit and marching off or something. But that was like, there were three or four circles of things happening, dynamics happening in that room.
I felt like the intention was probably to show how the stress was impacting everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But like so many things, it wasn't followed through enough for it to feel like it made sense to be there. That's the same with Detmer's PTSD. I felt like that was handled really poorly because when they started setting it up, I thought like they're going to do something with this. They're building towards something. But then later on, it's just like, okay, she's okay now. And then she, especially after she flies the Millennium Falcon around, she's fine.
It lasted for two or three shows, and then the comeback at the end. They touched it off there. Yeah. Yes, when she's flying the Millennium Falcon.
But it was presented in a way where it's supposed to be a mystery, and you're wondering, what's wrong with Detmer? How is this going to fit into the story? And then you find out, well, it doesn't really fit into the story. She just has PTSD, apparently. But we're not really going to explore how it's impacting her. That was my feeling as a viewer.
And it pops out when we need it.
So, anyway. So that's another one of those things where I feel like they have these ideas, but they have too much going on in the amount of time they have, and they can't follow through. And so things get lost. Yeah.
And again, I chalk that up to they're still figuring out the ways to juggle everything that they want to do. It's like great to have all these aims. And then, you know, people complain when they're not followed through the best they can. They're so far ahead of where they were the first season.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the storytelling is improving drastically. And so even if I look ahead to season four, like for me, I feel like the storytelling is starting to settle in a lot. when I think about this season. Most of the episodes I feel are either in the category of being standalones with a thread that's mm-hmm. running through for the season, or they're close to being standalone episodes. They're definitely not the everything blurs together kind of stories that we were getting in season one, especially.
Wasn't that a Mr. Rogers song? Everything blurs together because we're all one piece. Oh, no, I guess not. Okay.
Exactly. So I think they're going to continue to settle in. And I was also wondering before this season, will they stay in the 32nd century or will they end up coming back to their original mm-hmm. time period? Now I feel like probably they're going to stay mm-hmm. because we've got mm-hmm. Saru going to Kaminar. Michael is captain now. They're going to help Vance. They're going to help the Federation
right.
start to come back together. Like, they have found a new home and they're probably going to stay there. And I think that is going to allow the storytelling to maybe be a bit more character driven instead of it every season being like the whole galaxy mm-hmm. is going to end if we don't do this one thing.
Well, it's like
I think season four might yeah. not be like that.
It's the old trope of the Star Trek movies. You know, every movie has to be Earth is in peril and Enterprise is the only ship that can get there.
Right.
Getting out of that all or nothing. I was just going to say that I don't know if you heard this, but they've revealed lately that the actual original title for the opener and the finale was actually That Home Is You.
That Home Is You.
Yeah. And then they decided that that would sound weird. So they changed it to Hope. Okay. Sorry. Die trying.
Well, you know, the original title of that episode was D-Y-E, Die Trying. And it wasn't a seed vault. It was a Federation facility where they dyed the uniforms for each command engineering or science division. And they had lost contact with that.
Oh, okay. And and that sets up the mini arc that's played out where Tilly is wearing the wrong color at the end.
Exactly.
Of the
that's right.
See?
And it wasn't really a mistake. It was on purpose because there had been a dyeing error. And
yes.
See how it all fits together.
Come on.
The
hashtag
things that you think are mistakes and you complain about on social media, they're
hashtag
not always mistakes.
Texture not trivia. That's my hashtag. Texture not trivia. Yes. There is a tide.
All right. Okay, Larry. Well, there is a tide, and now we're talking about
there
clothes and colors.
I thought we were talking about Bama football. Okay, sorry. Okay. I thought you, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we've been talking for more than 2 hours, so let's wrap up for today. I know we didn't get into a lot of specifics, really. We kind of touched on a few points.
Well, you know, so many specifics, even in a 13-episode universe season, is a lot. That's a lot. We hit a lot of specifics here and some broad brushes, too. So
that's right. So, Larry, as you were telling me in our DMs recently, you just don't do much these days. You like sit around in your programmable matter Barca lounger, just relaxing and not doing anything, but probably something's going to come up on the horizon. So tell people what that might be and where they could find you.
Well, Chris, yes, even in programmable matter, LarryNemechek.com is still a good place to find me. Now, I'm talking to you here at my 47-degree tilted Barca lounger of programmable matter floating in the air in your ready room. I just have survived an incredible last few days. And the good thing is it's all still up there, everybody. So we had three panels for Virtual WonderCon, one of which was with the Voyager documentary team, which made, you know, they didn't just make history for their Voyager documentary and the crowdfunding. They made Indiegogo history. They made the most. They just topped 1 million as we record this, and they've got 2 or 3 days left. It's been amazing, and it's the buildup of goodwill through all their past documentaries and the DS9 people
and
all
contributed.
Yes,
I chose the Nana Visitor Zoom perk.
No one was talking about how the Nana Visitor perk was like getting more takers than some of the Voyager ones, but it's all good. It's all for the cause. Anyway, I was thrilled to moderate a panel for them virtually. To the cause.
Oh, no, that's not the name of the documentary.
That one's for Char.
Well, I will also say, Larry, that they've continued the trend, which CBS started when they named the Discovery After Show the Ready Room, mm-hmm. our show that's been going for 10 years. Now, another Trek a Film podcast name has been used for a documentary project. So I'm waiting for the year 2030 when they do the Enterprise documentary called Warp 5.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. That one may be safe. that one might be safe.
Okay.
But no, it was
anyway.
Back to your WonderCon panels. No, it was
okay. So they're online. People can watch.
They're online.
Them.
Yeah, and then Ali and I did a 1 hour version of Life Support Live that's up, and I had a really good fandom.
He's the real doctor for those who.
Yes, he's the real doctor. I'm the fake, and somehow people still listen to us. But we had a lot of fun with that one, and then I had a fandom panel talking about divisions online, and I've had more reaction to that panel. John Champin was in it, Ryan Britt, who has done a lot of writing, and people have not heard his voice and seen his visage, actually. So I was thrilled to get him on camera for once. And also Kennedy Allen, who's a podcaster with Women at Warp, and Ali Martinez, the 25-year T-Trekkie. Anyway, it was a good group, and I've had more feedback from email, much less online, to that panel from people I don't know, which is a good sign.
Hmm.
So that's been encouraging, but that's the WonderCon panels, and they'll be, and there's a lot of other good Trek ones too that are up, and they'll all be up for a long time. You can come to my site to see the links or whatever. But also, Life Support Live, we just turned our 50th episode, so it's almost been a year, and coming up, it'll be over by the time this is out, I believe. But we just celebrated my 200th episode of Trekland Tuesdays Live on Tuesday at 1 p.m. Wow. Pacific time, 4 Eastern. So
congratulations.
I invite everybody to, gosh, Chris, when you first called me to be on this podcast a couple of times, nearly 10 years ago, I should say, there should be another birthday party coming up in future for that. But I was thinking, gosh, and you said, you know, some of our podcasts are, the podcasts with you are the ones that are the most downloaded. And I'm like, I wonder if I should do something with this. Okay, well, maybe later. Yeah. Well, later finally got here. So, it's been a lot. It's been interesting. And the last year's evolution, watching the rest of the world in some ways catch up with whatever they're doing and go to virtual events has been kind of interesting because that's where
right.
Portal 47 has lived for 5 years trying to serve Trekdom to the entire world and deep dive. So, yeah, Portal 47 is doing really well and everything else. And I'm probably forgetting something, but I've opened a store if people want any of my logos on a thing. It's finally there. I'm behind you and everybody else, but we finally have a store up at Trekland and all the different shows and things. So that's been a lot of fun. I'm hoping to take a rest here a little bit, but that probably will never happen. But anyway, all the old haunts are still there.
Programmable matter can just turn into a bed. So
yes.
So
thank you for asking. Anyway, I'm going to take a rest, but I'm sure we'll be plugging away on something fresh and new coming up soon. I'm probably forgetting about it right now, but it's all good,
I'm pretty
Chris.
Sure.
How about you?
Good. I'm staying super busy as always. I've made my job transition that I talked about for a long time.
Yes. Congratulations.
And I'm now publishing the magazine that I have been editor in chief of for 5 years. And that's going well, but the transition itself is a lot of work. Hopefully we'll start to settle down now that we've got a couple of issues under our belts. I'm going to tweet out a link actually to that. Well, you've seen it, Larry, the magazine, but I'll tweet out a link where people can look at it if they're interested.
It's pretty high class, people. He's being very modest. It's very cutting edge and very professional.
Thank you. In terms of podcasting, I'm doing a bit more than I have been in the past few years. Matthew and I are doing some episodes of Literary Treks and some episodes of The Orb. And I'll be working on doing some episodes of some of the other ones coming up as well. Have some things in the hopper and some things written that I'm almost ready to get out there as soon as I'm able to do that. Mm. But basically, that's it. And then, you know, if you want to find me, the best place is on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's where I'm most active. That is my username everywhere on social media, but Twitter is really the main place where I'm active. So feel free to hit me up there and talk about Star Trek. And sometimes when I'm watching Star Trek, I'll tweet stuff out. So you can follow that if you're interested. And Larry, if people want to share their thoughts on what we talked about today with Discovery Season 3 or anything else about Star Trek, they can reach us by going to Twitter, of course. Mm-hmm. Our username there is TrekFM. Or you can send us email. If you go to the website trek.fm/contact, use the form there and send it to the Ready Room, and that'll come to me by email. Or you can go to Facebook and join our listeners group called the Babel Conference. If you're not yet a member, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field and it should come up. It is a private group, so you do need to answer the questions so that I can let you in. If you don't answer the questions, I can't let you in. And some people don't answer the questions, so I assume they're not listeners. And the reason we ask is because we want the group to be special for all of you who are listening, not just yet another random Facebook group. But that's a great place to talk to us and fellow listeners about the topics that we discuss here on the show. So please check that out. And if you'd like to help us keep all of this going, which does require quite a lot of money, we would love to have your support through Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can find out how to support us. You can become an associate producer. You can take part in the patrons roundtables, and we have other perks and a new section actually that I'm working on that will be available down the road. And we could definitely use your help. And I want to thank everyone who's supporting us now. And thank you to the associate producers of the network for keeping us going. Well, Larry, thanks for hanging out with me here in this makeshift ready room from Space IKEA. I'm going to try to spruce it up a little bit more before you're here next time.
Oh, don't touch the Barca loungers. I just got the programmable matter under control. And okay. Oh, you know what? On second thought, I'm going to bid you farewell. We've been at it for a couple of hours. Chris, I think it's time to stick a chunk of parasitic ice in it because the ready room is done.